When we think of the holiday season, we tend to think of twinkling lights, eggnog, family, feasts, warm fuzzies, and depending on what holidays you celebrate, the different traditions handed down to us from generations long since past. But though we tend to focus now on all this glittering, cheerful festivity, there is an older, darker side to this time of year that we like to forget. Winter was not always a time of plenty, feasting, and excess. In places where the snow would hit hard, the ground would freeze, the sun disappeared more quickly beneath the horizon, leaving the world in prolonged darkness, and the stocks from the harvest dwindled out slowly, it could be a time of uncertainty, fear, and survival. It was only natural for people to come together at times like these, hunker down with hearth and home, and find comfort in the presence of one another. And a cold winter night, wind and wolves howling, fire crackling, children wide-eyed at every bump and sound, was the perfect time for a ghost story. The time surrounding the winter solstice has been celebrated for millennia. This makes sense. Our ancestors the world over have noted the change in night and day length, the end of the growing season, the shift in weather, and they would have found their own explanations as to why these things were occurring. Beliefs, traditions, celebrations surrounding rebirth, death, and the passage of time have been a part of the human experience probably since there has been a human experience. And even more recently, the tradition of telling ghost stories was alive and well in the Victorian era. If you think about it, Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol, where Ebenezer Scrooge is visited by three different Christmas spirits, is, at its roots, a ghost story. The lyrics in the song The Most Wonderful Time of the Year, a popular Christmas song written by Edward Pola and George Weil in 1963, then famously recorded by Andy Williams, mentions the tradition of telling ghost stories. The lyrics actually say, "There'll be parties for hosting, marshmallows for toasting, and caroling out in the snow. There'll be scary ghost stories and tales of the glories of Christmases long, long ago." So today, I would like to continue that historical tradition and celebrate this time of year with you by telling you a ghost story. It's a fictional story and a part of literary history. It was written by British writer and scholar M.R. James and was published in 1904 in his collection entitled Ghost Stories of Antiquary. It's called Oh Whistle and I'll Come to You, My Lad. Since this story is going on 117 years old, it reads exactly like you'd expect something that's 117 years old to read. For that reason, I've reconfigured it a bit here and there for a 21st century audience. And in today's incredible 21st century audience are Vivia, Rhonda, and Christina, my newest patrons. A huge shout out to them and everyone who has helped to support this independent show. It took me a very long time to find the right story to tell you. I can't even tell you how many old Victorian stories and various folk tales from all over I poked through for this episode. I finally landed on this one because it appropriately takes place in winter. It's well over a century old, it has a ghost or two, it's public domain so I can't get sued for telling it, and it's the only one I found that has just a bit of archaeology in it, which basically makes it perfect. So cozy up, my friend, grab some nog, and get ready to call upon the ghost of Christmas past. I'm your host, Kristen Robine Terpstra, and this is the History Cache. Let's have a look inside. It was winter, and the days had all been gray for weeks. Classes had just ended, 1876 was drawing to a close, and the professor had decided it was time to go on holiday. Parkins was his name. He was young for a professor, especially one employed at such a coveted post as Cambridge. But he was proving himself a dedicated scholar. He was neat, precise in everything he did, and impeccably articulate. This gave some the impression that he was a bit fussy. He had been learning how to play golf during the term and decided he would take 10 days to travel to the coast to play, improve his game, and get a bit of work done. He wouldn't have been able to tell you the last time he'd traveled anywhere without his books. There was a small seaside town called Burnstow, and it was just the right number of train stops away from home. A colleague of his from the Department of Archaeology had asked him to, if it wouldn't be too much trouble, head down to the site of the old Templar's preceptory. It would be in ruins now, close to the beach due to the encroaching seashore, probably with nothing left above ground, but the archaeologist was interested in whether it would be a good spot for a future dig. Parkins, always well-mannered, even when a bit put out, had responded that, though he was an English professor himself and wasn't entirely sure what he would be looking at, he would be happy to report back with his thoughts. Inwardly, he sniffed at the idea that digging up an old preceptory could possibly be useful, but the site was within walking distance from the hotel, and Parkins enjoyed his evening walks. Plus, it would give him something to do on his off days. The train pulled into Barstow, midway through another gloomy morning. The wind off the sea was cold, and a mixture of snow and freezing rain could already be seen whirling off the water. Most of the lodging houses had been closed for winter, and the only place with a vacancy was at a hotel called the Globe Inn. It was a large seaside inn, old but well-kempt, so it had aged gracefully. The professor requested their largest room as he was planning on diving into his stout stack of books he had brought with him. The only room large enough to fulfill his request had two twin beds. This annoyed him, not because it was much of an inconvenience, but because it gave another one of his colleagues a reason to try and invite himself on Parkins' holiday. After a rather awkward but polite conversation, Parkins had managed to dissuade his colleague from pressing any further on the subject. He was not interested in passing his days off with anyone but himself, and from time to time, a golf partner. His colleague laughed and simply assured him he had just wanted to come keep Parkins company and help, quote, keep the ghosts off. That was a subject that made Parkins rather uncomfortable. If there was any subject upon which he had not an inkling of humor, it was the childish idea of ghosts. Parkins thought of this for a moment as he entered the room. It was a nice room. Three large bay windows looked out over the beach, and he could see a few hardy seabirds diving down into the waves. The one annoyance was that there were no curtains or blinds covering the windows. They had been removed for cleaning after the summer season. But Parkins paid no mind. The days were short, and he supposed the long nights of winter should provide enough darkness for him to sleep. He immediately got to arranging his things exactly where they needed to go. There were a few other guests at the hotel hoping to enjoy some golf if the weather allowed, and from the looks of it, the sky had cleared into a less intimidating light gray. Parkins decided to head out and enjoy the course. While there, he met Colonel Williams, another patron of the inn. He was an outspoken man with a pipe and a healthy mustache perched beneath a couple of scrutinizing blue eyes. The two made arrangements to play a round together the next day. Well, the colonel had made arrangements, and Parkins wasn't one to argue. Preferring to walk back to the inn on his own after what had been a rather pleasant game, Parkins suddenly remembered the request from his archaeological colleague and thought heading down to the ruins on the beach would be a great excuse to avoid having to walk back to the inn with Colonel Williams. Brandy and tobacco were calling to the colonel too strongly for him to be interested in an archaeological side quest, so Parkins set off on his own, back towards the beach. The light was fading as Parkins moved towards the shore, and he wasn't entirely sure what he was looking for. He was picking his way from the grass to the shingled beach when his foot caught between a stone and a gorse root, and he toppled over. He hurried back to his feet, looking around in embarrassment, relieved no one else had been around to catch him in such an ungraceful moment, except for some seabirds searching for morsels carried in by the evening tide. He surveyed his surroundings and found himself in a patch of somewhat broken ground covered with small depressions and mounds. Digging at one of the mounds with the toe of his shoe, he discovered flint and mortar overgrown with turf. He knew then he had found the old Templar preceptory. Even with a complete lack of archaeological experience, Parkins knew this site would be enough to get any archaeologist's heart ticking like a tightly wound pocket watch. Everything seemed to be just below the surface and would be easy work for even a dull trowel. He vaguely remembered that the Templars to whom this site had belonged were in the habit of building round churches, and he thought a particular series of humps and mounds near him did appear to be arranged in something of a circular form. Few people can resist the temptation to try a little amateur research in a department quite outside of their own, if only for the satisfaction of showing how successful they would have been had they only taken it up seriously. Our professor was no different, however, he was also truly anxious to oblige his colleague. So he paced with care the circular area, the ancient stones covered in new grass, and wrote down its rough dimensions in his pocketbook. He then proceeded to examine the oblong protrusion, which lay just askew the center of the circle, and seemed to his thinking likely to be the base of a platform, or perhaps an altar. At one end of it, a patch of the turf was gone, likely removed by some child or curious passerby. It might, he thought, be as well to probe the soil here for evidence of masonry, and he took out his pocket knife, quite pleased he had the occasion to use it, and began scraping away at the earth. What followed was another curious discovery. A portion of soil fell inward as he scraped and divulged a small cavity in the ground. He had been so absorbed in his task that the creeping darkness of night had almost caught him unawares. But he couldn't stop now. He took the matchbook from his pocket and lit one match after another to help him see what was inside the hole. But the wind was too strong for the small flames. By tapping and scratching the sides with his knife, he was able to make out that he must have discovered a small artificial hole in the masonry. It was rectangular, and the sides, top and bottom, if not actually plastered, were smooth and regular. He felt a pang of disappointment at believing it to be empty, but as he withdrew his knife, he heard a metallic clink. And when he reached inside with his hand, it met with a cylindrical object lying on the floor of the hole. Naturally enough, he picked it up, and when he brought it into the light, now nearly gone, he could see that it, too, was made by human hands. A metal tube, about 4 inches long, and evidently of some considerable age. By the time Parkins had made sure that there was nothing else in this odd receptacle, it was too late and too dark for him to think of undertaking any further search. What he had done had proved so unexpectedly interesting that he determined to sacrifice a little more daylight tomorrow to explore the site. The object, which he now had safe in his pocket, was bound to be of some slight value at least, he felt sure. The stretch of beach leading back to the hotel was bleak and solemn. The shingled beach crunched beneath his feet. And with the light gone, the only indication he was on a beach at all came from the sound of waves, the smell of salt, and the moonlight flickering across the black water. A faint yellow light in the west showed a few figures moving towards the clubhouse that were still visible. The squat Martello Tower, the lights of the village, and the pale ribbon of sands intersected at intervals by black wooden fences, the dim and murmuring sea. The wind was bitter from the north, but it was at his back. He moved faster now, rattling and clashing through the shingle until his feet found sand. The going was both good and quiet, and easy now except for having to hop over the occasional wooden groin, those wooden fences set up and down the beach to help prevent erosion, though from the look of it, they weren't doing much good. Eventually the sea would swallow the inn, claiming another ruin for the sand. He looked back behind him to measure the distance he'd made since leaving the ruins, and he spotted a shape. It was hard to make out in the darkness, but it had a human distinction about it, and it was moving almost as if it were trying to catch up with him, though it wasn't making much progress. Not wishing to meet any company on this dark, lonely shore, Our professor picked up his pace, relieved when he finally found himself back at the inn among his carefully laid clothes and his books. He barely had time to dress for dinner, but made it out to the dining room in as fine a display as ever. The evening passed in relaxed amiability, and conversation with the inn's other guests turned out to be surprisingly engaging. He returned to his room quite satisfied with his first day in Burnstow. When he reached for his bedclothes, he inadvertently knocked his coat to the floor, and the curious object from the old ruins rolled out of the pocket. He picked it up, and it was with some considerable curiosity that he turned it over slowly in his fingers and examined it by the light of the candles. It was made of bronze, he now saw, and was shaped very much after the manner of a dog whistle. In fact, it was. Yes, it certainly was, actually no more nor less than a whistle. How odd. He put it to his lips, but found it was full of a fine, caked-up sand or earth, which would not yield to knocking, but must be loosened with a knife. Tidy as ever in his habits, Parkins cleared out the earth onto a piece of paper and took the ladder to the window to empty it out. The night was clear and bright as he looked out the large bay windows. When he gazed out towards the sea, he saw a belated wanderer stationed on the shore in front of the inn, a dark silhouette against the water. He shut the window, a little surprised at the late hours people kept at Burnstow, and took his whistle to the light again. As he rubbed the dirt away, he saw that there were letters, words even, inscribed on the sides, a deeply cut inscription, quite legible, but unfortunately, in Latin. A language he had to admit was not his strongest. There were words both on the front and on the back of the whistle. The first inscription was a jumble of words rearranged into a cross. He thought it read, "Fur flabis flebis." The other, perhaps, "Cuistest esta cui venit." I ought to be able to make it out, he thought, but I suppose I am a little rusty in my Latin. When I come to think of it, I don't believe I even know the word for a whistle. The long phrase does seem simple enough. It ought to mean, who is this? Who is coming? Well, the best way to find out is evidently to whistle for him. He blew tentatively, then stopped, suddenly, startled and yet pleased at the note he had elicited. It had a quality of infinite distance in it. And as soft as it was, he somehow felt it must be audible for miles around. It was a sound, too, that seemed to have the power of forming pictures in his mind. He saw quite clearly, for a moment, a vision of a wide, dark expanse at night, with a fresh wind blowing, and in the midst, a lonely figure. Exactly who or what, he could not tell. Perhaps he would have seen more had not the picture in his mind been broken by the sudden surge of wind against the window. The gust was so sudden that it made him look up just in time to see what he thought was the white glint of a seabird's wing somewhere outside the dark panes. He tried the whistle again, this time more boldly. But the sound wasn't much louder than before, and the illusion that had formed in his mind had failed to manifest a second time. Again, the wind slammed the window, thrusting it open violently, this time extinguishing the lights from his candles. The wind continued to blow so strongly now that he wondered if the entire inn would be torn to pieces. He rushed forward to close the window. So strong was the wind, he felt as if it were pushing back at him. He managed to press the window closed, and it latched shut with a satisfying click. He relit the candles and examined the room for any damage. Surprisingly, there was none, but he could hear Colonel Williams stomping and grumbling in the room above his. Apparently, the colonel had also been roused by the wind, which continued to howl outside. At times it rose to a cry so desolate, he speculated that, if he had been a more fanciful man, prone to the ramblings of imagination, he might have been made to feel quite uneasy. He settled down to sleep, but sleep eluded him. Whether it was the wind, or the excitement of golf, or the research in the preceptory that kept Parkins awake, he was not sure. The more determined he was to sleep, the more the possibility of it slipped away. He experienced strange pictures in his mind, the kind that come to you between sleep and wake, though he was quite sure he was conscious. The picture seemed continuous. When he opened his eyes, it left him, but when he closed them once more, it framed itself afresh again, seeming to pick up where it had left off. In his mind, he saw a long stretch of shore, shingle-edged by sand, and intersected at short intervals with wooden groins running down to the water, a scene, in fact, so like that of his afternoon's walk that in the absence of any landmark, it could not be distinguished therefrom. The light was obscure, conveying an impression of a gathering storm. Late winter evening, a slight, cold rain. On this bleak stage at first, no actor was visible. Then, in the distance, a bobbing black object appeared. A moment more, and it was a man, running, jumping, clambering over the groins, and every few seconds looking frantically behind him. The nearer he came, the more obvious it was that he was not only anxious, but even terribly frightened, though his face was not distinguishable. He seemed almost at the end of his strength, yet on and on he ran. Each successive obstacle seemed to cause him more difficulty than the last. Half climbing, half throwing himself, he leapt over another groin and fell into a heap on the other side. There, as if unable to get up again, he remained crouching, close to the earth, looking up in painful anxiety. So far, Parkins could see no cause whatsoever for the fear the runner had been showing. But now there began to be seen, far up the shore, a little flicker of something. Light-colored, moving to and fro with great swiftness and irregularity. Rapidly, it grew larger, an eerie figure in pale, fluttering rags, ill-defined. There was something about its motion which made Parkins dread seeing it at close quarters. It would stop, raise its arms, bow itself towards the sand, then run stooping across the beach to the water's edge and back again, and then, rising upright, once more continue its course forward at a speed that was startling and terrifying. The moment came when the pursuer was hovering just a few yards beyond the groin where the runner lay in hiding. After two or three ineffectual castings hither and thither, it came to a stop, stood upright with arms raised high, and then darted straight towards the hiding man. Parkins sat up in bed. He blamed this vision on an overworked mind, excessive smoking, the pudding at dinner. He finally resigned himself to light his candle, get out a book, and pass the night reading, rather than be tormented by these persistent images which he saw clearly enough could only be a morbid reflection of his walk and his thoughts from the day. The scraping of match on box. And the glare of light must have startled some creatures of the night, rats, perhaps, which he heard scurry across the floor from the side of his bed with much rustling. A candle and a book were duly procured, over which Parkins pored until a sleep of a wholesome kind came upon him. For about the first time in his orderly and prudent life, he forgot to blow out the candle before he fell asleep, and when he was called next morning at 8, there was still a flicker in the socket and a sad mess of guttered grease on the top of the little table. After a much-needed breakfast, he returned to his room to change into his golf clothes and ran into the housekeeper who was finishing up the room. She asked him, "Would you like any extra blankets on your bed, sir?" "Ah, thank you," replied Parkins. "Yes, I think I should like one. It seems likely to turn rather cold tonight." She grabbed an extra blanket. "Which bed should I put it on, sir?" she asked. "Why, that one, the one I slept in last night," he said, pointing to the bed closest the window. "Oh, yes, I beg your pardon, but you seem to have tried both of them. We had to make them both up this morning." "Really," said Parkins, "I certainly never touched the other, except to lay some things on it. Did it actually seem to have been slept in?" "Oh, yes," she replied. "Why, the blankets and sheets were crumpled and thrown about, as if someone had passed a rather restless night." "Dear me," said Parkins, "well, I must have disordered it more than I thought when I unpacked my things. I'm very sorry to have given you the extra trouble. It's no trouble, she said, placing the extra blanket on Parkin's bed and retiring from the room. Unperturbed and used to ignoring odd things, Parkin set forth with a stern determination to improve his game. He partnered up with the Colonel once again, and the two discussed the windstorm which had kept them both awake for much of the night. "Extraordinary wind we had last night," said the Colonel. "In my old home we should have said someone had been whistling for it." "Should you indeed," said Parkins. "Is there a superstition of that kind still current in your part of the country?" "I don't know about superstition," said the Colonel. "They believe in it all over Denmark and Norway, as well as on the Yorkshire coast. And my experience is, mind you, that there's generally something at the bottom of what these country folk hold to, and have held to, for generations." Parkins tried hard not to scoff aloud, and replied, "Colonel, I think I ought to tell you that my own views on such subjects are very strong. I am, in fact, a convinced disbeliever in what is called the supernatural." "Oh," said the Colonel, "do you mean to tell me that you don't believe in second sight, or ghosts, or anything of that kind?" "In nothing whatsoever of that kind," returned Perkins firmly. "Well," said the Colonel, "it appears to me at that rate, sir, that you must be a little close-minded." Perkins, doubtful that this conversation was going anywhere useful, preferred to laugh the accusation off. "Perhaps I am," he said. "But as to this whistling for the wind, let me give you my theory about it. The laws which govern the winds are really not at all perfectly known, to fisherfolk and such, of course, not known at all. A man or woman of eccentric habits, perhaps, or a stranger, is seen repeatedly on the beach at some unusual hour and is heard whistling. Soon afterwards, a violent wind arises. Anyone who could read the sky perfectly or who possessed a barometer could have foretold that it would. But the simple people of a fishing village have no barometers and only a few rough rules for prophesizing weather. It's natural, then, that such people would believe some eccentric whistling person or stranger should be regarded as having raised the wind. Now, take last night's wind. As it happens, I myself was whistling. I blew a whistle twice, and the wind seemed to come absolutely in answer to my call. If anyone had seen me, whistling, were you?" the Colonel interrupted. "And what sort of whistle did you use?" "It's a rather curious one," Parkins replied. "I found it yesterday." Parkins told the Colonel the story of his unexpected discovery, and for the first time since they had met, Parkins saw the Colonel become uncomfortable. The subject was changed, and the two played their game well into the afternoon, until they both forgot their talk of superstitions, and the light began to fade. After their game, and the two started their walk back to the inn, Parkins suddenly remembered he had meant to return to the ruins and poke around a bit more. But it was getting too late for that now. But no matter, tomorrow would be just as good a day for some exploration. When the two made it back to the inn and turned the corner of the house, the Colonel was almost knocked down by a boy who crashed into him at the top of his speed, and then, instead of running away, remained hanging on to him. The Colonel was about to reprimand the boy, but noticed he was almost speechless with fright. The two asked the child what had happened, but the questions were useless for some minutes until the boy caught his breath and eased his trembling. He would not let go of the Colonel. "What in the world is the matter with you? What have you been up to? What have you seen?" asked the Colonel. "I saw it wave to me from the window," wailed the boy, "and I didn't like it." "What window?" said the Colonel, becoming irritated. "Come pull yourself together, my boy." "The front window, by the beach," said the boy. They pressed the child. "Was it the top window or the bottom one?" "The top one," the boy replied. "The big one with the two smaller ones on either side." This startled Parkins, because he knew the boy had just described the window to his own room. They assured the boy he had not seen anything dangerous, gave him a shilling to brighten his mood, and sent him on his way. Parkins asked the Colonel to come with him to his room and make sure no one had been into his things. He was worried the boy had seen a thief through the window. They reached the room and found the door still locked. Parkins then wondered if someone with a key had been trifling through his things while he was away. But when they entered the room, they found nothing in disarray, nor any evidence that anything had been touched. Except for the second bed. It again looked as if someone had slept in it. The blankets had been twisted and kicked about into odd shapes. Troubled, Parkins and the Colonel rang the housekeeper. She assured them that no one had been in the room since the morning. This was a puzzle. A cursory investigation showed that nothing of value had been taken, and Parkins remembered the disposition of the small objects on tables and so forth well enough to be fairly certain that no one had touched them. The manager even assured him that she had not given the duplicate key of the room to any person during the day. Nor could Perkins, who was fairly adept at reading people, detect anything in the demeanor of anyone that indicated guilt. He was much more inclined to think that the boy had been playing a prank on them. At dinner that evening, the Colonel was unwontedly silent and pensive. When he bade goodnight to Parkins, he murmured in a gruff undertone, "You know where I am, if you need anything." "Why, yes, thank you, Colonel Wilson, but there isn't much prospect of my disturbing you, I hope. By the way," he added, "did I show you that old whistle I spoke of? I think not. Well, here it is." Parkins had placed it in his dinner jacket pocket, thinking the Colonel would have been interested in seeing it. The Colonel took it from Parkins and turned it over gingerly in the light of the candles. "Can you make anything of the inscription?" asked Parkins as he took it back. "No, not in this light. What do you mean to do with it?" "Oh, well, when I get back to Cambridge, I'll hand it over to the archaeologists there and see what they think of it. And very likely, if they consider it worth having, I may present it to one of the museums." Grunted the Colonel. "Well, you may be right. All I know is that if it were mine, I would chuck it straight into the sea." He handed the whistle back to the professor and turned away. Soon they had both retired to their respective rooms. That night, the moon was nearly full, and Parkins was annoyed now that there were no blinds or curtains in his room, as the moon would shine directly on his bed, and he preferred to sleep in absolute darkness. With some prompt, impressive ingenuity, he rigged together a rug, some safety pins, an umbrella, a spare sheet, and a stick to erect a small screen, which, if it held, would serve to keep the blue glow of moonlight away. He snuggled into bed, read for a bit until his eyes grew tired, then, after casting a drowsy glance around the room, blew out the candle and fell eagerly back upon the pillow. He slept soundly for around an hour when a sudden clatter startled him awake. His impromptu screen had given way and a bright, frosty moon was shining directly on him. He did not want to get up and wrestled with himself for a while as to whether it would be worth it to get up and reconstruct his makeshift screen or whether he could fall asleep without it. For some minutes, he lay and pondered over all the possibilities. Then he turned over sharply, and with his eyes open, lay breathlessly listening. There had been a movement, he was sure, in the empty bed on the opposite side of the room. Tomorrow he would have it moved, for there must be rats or something playing about in it. It was quiet for a moment. Then the commotion began again. There was a rustling and shaking, surely more than any rat could cause. What followed within a singular, dreadful moment was a malevolent pairing of bewilderment and horror. For it was then that the professor saw a figure suddenly sit up in what he had known was an empty bed. He was out of his own bed in one bound, making a frantic dash towards the window where lay his only weapon, the stick with which he had propped up his makeshift moonscreen. This was, as it turned out, the worst thing he could have done, because the person, the thing, in the empty bed, with a sudden smooth motion, slipped from the bed and took up a position, with outspread arms, between the professor and the door. Parkins watched it with horrid perplexity. Somehow the idea of getting past it and escaping through the door was inconceivable to him, for he could not imagine touching it. And as for it touching him, he would sooner dash himself through the window than have that happen. The thing stood for a moment in a band of dark shadow, and he had not yet seen its face. Now it began to move in a stooping posture, and all at once the professor realized, with some horror and some relief, that the specter must be blind, for it seemed to feel about with its muffled arms in a groping and random fashion. Turning halfway from a silent and still Parkins, it became suddenly conscious of the bed the professor had just left, and darted towards it, and bent and felt over the pillows in a way which made Perkins shudder in a manner he had never in his life thought possible. The thing was searching for him. In a moment, it seemed to know that the bed was empty, and then, moving forward into the area of moonlight facing the window, it showed for the first time what manner of thing it was. Parkins, stricken with fear, saw an intensely horrible face of crumpled linen and twisted bedsheets. What expression he read upon it he could not tell, but the fear of it struck him near to madness. But he was not at leisure to watch it for long. With formidable quickness, it moved into the middle of the room, and as it groped and waved, one corner of its draperies swept across Parkins' face. He could not, though he knew how perilous a sound was, keep back a cry of disgust, and this immediately gave away his position. It leapt towards him in an instant, and the next moment it had pushed him halfway through the window, his spine curving painfully backwards, uttering cry upon cry at the utmost pitch of his voice, and the linen face was thrust close into his own. Parkins felt the cold sea air on his face and believed completely that he would be thrust from the window down to a cold death in the sand. At this, almost the last possible second, deliverance came. As you will have guessed, the colonel burst the door open and was just in time to see the dreadful pair at the window. When he reached the figures, only one was left. Parkins sank forward into the room in a faint, and before him on the floor lay a tumbled heap of bedclothes. Colonel Wilson asked no questions, but busied himself in keeping everyone else out of the room and in getting Parkins back to his bed. The colonel, wrapped in a blanket, occupied the other bed for the rest of the night, keeping watch over an inconsolable Parkins. Early on the next day, when the light of morning dawn cracked through the darkness of their nightmare, the colonel left the hotel door carrying a small object between his finger and his thumb, which he cast as far into the sea as his arm could send it. Later on, the smell of burning linen ascended from the back premises of the inn. Exactly what explanation was patched up for the staff and visitors at the hotel, no one seems to recollect. The professor was somehow cleared of the ready suspicion of delirium tremens, and the hotel of the reputation of a troubled house. There is not much question as to what would have happened to Parkins if the colonel had not intervened when he did. He would either have fallen out of the window, or else lost his wits. But it is not so evident what more the creature that came in answer to the whistle could have done than frighten. There seemed to be absolutely nothing material about it save the bedclothes of which it had made itself a body. The colonel, who remembered not a very dissimilar occurrence in the service, was of the opinion that if Parkins had closed with it, it really would have done very little, and that its one power was that of causing fear. As you may imagine, the professor's views on superstition are less clear-cut than they used to be. His nerves, too, have suffered. He cannot even now see a shirt hanging on a door, nor the spectacle of a scarecrow in a field late on a winter afternoon. Even the smell of old linen has, on occasion, cost him more than one sleepless night. When he returned to Cambridge, curiosity eventually won out over the disgust of remembrance, and Parkins decided to uncover the meaning of the Latin he had seen on the cursed whistle. He had been right about the first inscription, "Quistest esta cui venit," meaning, "Who is it that comes?" And the second, visually rearranged on the whistle as "Fur flabis flebis," meant, "Thief, if you blow this whistle, you will weep." Some things, Parkins decided, were best left for archaeologists. Well, I hope you enjoyed your wintry, century-old ghost story. And I hope even more that as this year comes to a close, you are somewhere warm and comforting, and that all the trouble you may have experienced this year passes with the coming of 2021. Like the professor in M.R. James's story, this year has given us all a ghost or two to leave behind. A new year always feels like a new beginning, and if it's a new beginning you're after, well, I hope you get it, and I hope this holiday season, whatever it means to you, and this marking of the passage of a truly historic year, finds you well and healthy and happy. I will be back in 3 weeks with another piece of history for you. Until then, you can get a hold of me at historycashpodcast@gmail.com. You can support the show by telling a friend, reviewing, subscribing wherever you listen, becoming a patron for as little as $1 a month on Patreon at patreon.com/historycashpodcast, or by making a one-time donation under the support tab at the website historycashpodcast.podbean.com, or just by listening. Every download counts and matters. Thank you so, so much for listening, friend. And until we meet again, go make some history.